This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 2nd, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 385. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and on the big deal feature, what's happening in British Columbia's former capital city? New Westminster Times editor Dave Brett joins me to talk about the Patella Bridge, the NDP's decriminalization disaster, and the circus at City Hall. Plus, BC's budget is coming the same day that Donald Trump is threatening to slap tariffs on Canadian goods. So why did five members of John Rustad's Conservative Opposition Caucus vote against condemning Trump? Surrey South's Brent Chapman and Vancouver Quilchina's Dallas Brody explain why. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. New Westminster, the Royal City, British Columbia's original capital in 1858. The geographic center of Metro Vancouver with a population in 2025 that is pushing 90,000. Joining me is Dave Brett, the editor of the New Westminster Times. You can find it at newwesttimes.com. He calls his hometown a microcosm for the province, and he is my guest on this edition of the podcast. I started by asking Dave Brett for the latest on the new $1.6 billion Patella Bridge. It is supposed to open this fall, which would be more than a year late and $300 million higher than the NDP promised.
There was a very tragic accident on the old Patella Bridge, sort of underscoring the importance of bringing the new bridge online as soon as possible. Three people were killed. The old Patella Bridge has this bend on the Surrey side that's notorious for accidents, and so, you know, people are looking over at the new bridge. And the other topic that always comes up in New Westminster about the new bridge is that it's only four lanes, the same capacity as the old bridge. So you have different camps here. Like, why are we replacing a four-lane bridge with a four-lane bridge? So if you want to get a feisty conversation going into Westminster, bring that up.
You've run some stories that have caught a lot of people's attention in recent weeks and months about the drug decriminalization experiment, which went wrong here in British Columbia. The latest one was titled Bedlam, BC's Harm Reduction Gravy Train. You looked at the spending by the BC Ministry of Mental Health and Addictions, which doesn't exist anymore. It's been folded back into the Ministry of Health since David Eby and the NDP won re-election in the fall. How much money has gone awry in this experiment?
That's a good question. And I think it's the fact that it's difficult to answer that question is interesting. In my article about the gravy train, I focused attention on just two of the organizations that had received considerable money through the former Ministry of Mental Health and Addictions, the Canadian Mental Health Association BC Division. And they, in their last fiscal period, received something like $74 million for a treatment bed program. And then there was a related organization called the Community Action Initiative. And I believe their Ministry of Mental Health dollars was in the neighborhood of $30 million. So I kind of did a deep dive on those two organizations, looking at their financial statements, and I'd never heard of the Community Action Initiative before it was brought up by one of the counselors in New Westminster. She was kind of scolding some of the folks that were objecting to a safe inhalation site in downtown Westminster, saying, well, you should look at the Community Action Initiative and get yourself educated by going to that site. And, well, I went there and I was surprised to find out the scope and scale of what that organization was. And I started looking at their financial statements and was kind of bowled over at many of the things that I found in the financial disclosures of the organization. You know, for example, they listed in granular detail every nonprofit who they had provided a grant to. And I just simply started looking up some of the grantees and was shocked to find that a lot of the money flowed to what can only really be considered activist organizations. Like there was one called the Coalition of Peers Dismantling the Drug War. And, you know, just a quick look at their website, and they were, you know, advocating for defunding the police, abolishing the Illegal Drug Act, and, you know, looking to free all the prisoners in prisons across the country. Anyway, and defending drug dealers and saying, calling them, you know, saying they're keeping their community safe. So I thought, so that kind of is how I kind of went into it. But it is, I think it's, I ended up, you know, coming to the conclusion that a public inquiry into this is required. And that, I think, was picked up by a lot of the other people watching this issue. In particular, there's a bit of it's a bit murky as to what's really going on there, because their financial year end is March 31. So what I'm looking at, what you can actually see at this point in time from their financials, only goes to March, is up to March 31, 2024. So what has happened between now and then? And of course, they don't publish their financials until, you know, 3, 4, 5 months after the year end. So it just seemed like there was a lot of irregularities in the financial disclosures that warrant a deeper dive into what's happening. You know, what beds are being built? What are the conditions on the treatment beds? One of the things I found alarming was that the $73, $74 million that the Canadian Mental Health Association has got to add new treatment beds was really just to fund existing beds in existing facilities, but there's a lot of catches and strings attached to the money. And I think that was surprising to people. So yeah, there's a lot of what appeared to be bloated nonprofit overhead. Millions and millions and millions going to wages for people to run the organizations. And then it's kind of like a pyramid scheme. You've got the bigger organizations, their staff, the next organization, their staff, and then all the dozens and dozens of nonprofits also have staff. So I could go on about the details that kind of I found quite shocking that were audited. So I think they're reliable numbers, and people started digging from there.
Now, you also looked at safe supply deaths and the missing data. It used to be illicit drug toxicity deaths. Now they're using the new phrase unregulated drug deaths. What is the difference?
My wife and I kind of come by our interest in this topic, honestly. We have a son. We have three boys, one of which was a homeless, mentally ill, drug-addicted man living on the streets of New Westminster for the better part of 20 years. And so we have very closely followed the numbers. He overdosed 12 times. And so we have this personal experience dealing with the system, as it were. But we're also very much focused on the policies related to these interwoven crises. And so we're, for example, I'll give you an example. My wife was a founding member of the New Westminster Homelessness Coalition. So we're very aware of, you know, what the needs are in the community. So we've been looking at the coroner's reports for several years because we were alarmed about the safety supply and the approach and the harm reduction approach the government was taking. We didn't think that was beneficial. And I noticed that they had changed the terminology from, as you say, illicit drug toxicity deaths to unregulated drug deaths. So I reached out to the coroner's media relations and I got an explanation as to what was behind the change. They said it was to reduce stigma because they didn't like the word illicit. So they removed the word illicit. But I said, well, what if someone dies? So then, since the government got into the business of prescribing fentanyl in tablet form and in patches, what if someone dies from that supply because it's no longer quote-unquote unregulated? It's still fentanyl, but it's regulated fentanyl. So there's a whole series of toxic and deadly drugs that are now not reported in the category of unregulated deaths, drug deaths. So I said, well, what? Where would they be? Where would they end up? Well, the response was they would call them drug poisoning or prescription drug poisoning deaths. Well, when the 2024 numbers came out, I scoured through the data and, well, there was no category for that. So, and there was a chart in the data that did show prescription poisoning deaths, but mysteriously the chart ended at 2022. So the last 2 years where they kind of shifted the categories was missing. So I followed up with the coroner's service and asked them to explain this discrepancy, and I didn't get a reply. And I followed up again, no reply. So this, I think, is a, you know, they reported a 13% in overall deaths, you know, hey, good news. But I thought, well, wait a minute. There's missing information here. We're not getting the whole picture. So I thought that was, it's still an outstanding question that I think the government has to explain, as is, if you've recategorized and redefined the categories, how is this affecting the data? No answers.
Reminds me of what the late, great Rafe Mayer once said, that he said that figures don't lie, but liars can figure. I understand there's a proposal for a drug inhalation site in downtown New Westminster. How close is this to coming to fruition?
It's not entirely clear from the disclosures at City Council. I try to go to every City Council meeting in New Westminster, but they have kind of cleverly sandwiched the inhalation site into like a much larger document about their 5 to 10 year pilot project and to deal with all of a whole panoply of interrelated issues. You know, their argument is, well, people are using on the street. Businesses are, and residents are complaining about the open drug use. Well, let's move it inside. So This is a proposal being made by the Purpose Society, which has got an office located on Begbie Street, which is just off Columbia. So residents are not convinced, and I personally am not convinced, that this will either A, reduce street level disorder. In fact, it could make it considerably worse by just kind of creating a kind of center of gravity, if you will, for people to populate and increase population in that area. So these kind of arguments are simply not listened to. The majority of the council in New Westminster are with a party called Community First, which is an NDP-linked group. There's a couple of councillors, Daniel Fontaine and Paul Minhas, who are typically voting against things like this, but there's a very dismissive attitude, you know, and this constant hectoring. While you're just stigmatizing, and this idea that if you object to these street-level harm reduction strategies, well, you're just adding to harmful stigma and causing, making the problem worse. So it remains to be seen whether the organization will get funded to actually put the inhalation site in, but it's causing a lot of consternation in town because people fear that New Westminster's downtown, which was kind of on track to make a big turnaround from it's a long history downtown New Westminster, but people are concerned that it's going to kind of go the way of the downtown east side and to regress in its progress. So that's a hot topic here in the Royal City.
New Westminster City Council keeps giving you plenty of material, and one of the more recent stories, Absurd Assembly, New Westminster's New Age Civic Engagement Experiment.
What this pilot project, one-year pilot project that New Westminster embarked on, is emblematic of a larger trend in society that seems to get concentrated here in New Westminster, and that is that it is the diversity, equity, and inclusion lens on everything. So this advisory assembly replaced a raft of other committees. So they said, oh, well, all these, this raft or 8 or 10 committees, we're not happy with them because supposedly the voices that they're wanting to hear are not coming forward, or they get, there's this kind of idea that they had to select the members of this large super committee of effectively on a what they called a intersectional basis. So the selection of the members was entirely based on identity, and they included children. So kids as young as 12, 13, 14, you know, high school kids were in this group, and you think, okay, and there were no one was selected based on their domain knowledge of any particular issue or their expertise. People were filtered and screened out based on their income, whether they owned or rented, or it was this kind of utopian idea that they could create this group that reflects the community. Well, the way in which, and I spent a long time, this advisory assembly created minutes and notes from all of their meetings, and they're very detailed. And I was kind of shocked to find the way they were spending their time was doing things like an exercise they call the fishbowl. They would take an identity group, put them in the middle of the room, and they kind of do this circle around. And talk about how climate change affected them on an intersectional basis. So it just seemed, frankly, ridiculous that taxpayer funds and the folks that were, you know, facilitating this were from Simon Fraser University and, dare I say, a rather woke kind of approach to trying to discern and divine out and pull out of these, you know, kids and others, how climate change affects them. Well, I'm a kid, so how does it affect me? Well, so there was a whole bunch of different role-playing exercises. It seemed more like a self-help. And this is kind of some of the feedback that's come out of it is that, well, I found it a wonderful experience connecting with some people that I'd never met before. As if that is the measure of success.
Kind of a long-running saga that happened late 2023 into 2024. City council meetings were besieged by people from SAMUDUM, the Vancouver anti-Israel pro-Hamas group that was declared by the Canadian and U.S. governments last fall as a terrorist group. Supporters of SAMUDUM showed up at city council meetings in New Westminster, disrupting city council. Last time I checked, New Westminster didn't have a seat at the United Nations.
Yeah, this was quite a revelation. You know, the actual wording of these quote-unquote ceasefire motions that kept popping up everywhere, it seemed like New Westminster was ground zero for this strategy that what we now know to be SAMUDUM and other sort of pro-Hamas organizations were going before city councils. And, you know, magically, these resolutions would be put. And you think, well, where did the wording for these resolutions come from? And, you know, one of the more radical councillors had made this motion. But it was, you know, quite shocking, the level of disruption and the sheer numbers of people that came out. You know, there were you know, people would just start, you know, heckling, you know, snickering, and, you know, just getting out of order. And the poor city clerk would be saying, well, hey, folks, we have a rule. You have to sit down. So people wouldn't sit down. And then someone got angry because everyone was filming everyone. And then before you know it, the whole thing, gallery just erupted and we started filming it. And, you know, so I think when we put that on X, people were quite shocked that there was yelling, there was pointing, accusations, and just a general disorder. And yeah, one of the, you talk about filibustering is that, you know, New Westminster has rules for who can do a public delegation. You get 5 minutes, but you're supposed to give your name to City Hall in advance, usually a day or two. And there's this rule, well, you can't all talk on the same topic. So if say one or two people are speaking on the ceasefire motion, well, that's it. So what they would do is they would say, well, I want to talk about the rezoning application on XYZ Avenue and say, well, I'd like to talk about this rezoning application and its implications for colonial domination. And they would shift the conversation from the topic they were assigned to go on a rant about the genocide in Gaza and how it got got really bad. And one of the guys, a fellow named Saeed Naguib, who's associated with SAMUDUM, he shut down the whole council. He came in as a delegate and refused to leave the podium, and that was it. And this guy later was learned that, and he was, you know, defending Charlotte Cates, the director of Samadun, and this guy, I wrote an article about him and his connections to Samadun and his, you know, upbringing, sort of silver spoon upbringing at private schools and Ivy Leagues, and his dad's connection to a well-known and very large fraud. And anyway, this guy, Saeed Naguib, has now created a website about David Brett. It just says, avoid the racist blogger David Brett. Anyway, so we, from the New Westminster experience, we ended up going to places, to other city councils like Port Moody, where there was a gong show. If you remember, Port Moody passed a ceasefire resolution and then rescinded it. And this caused great consternation, and even larger crowd of people showed up there because they have, you know, a bigger council chamber than New Westminster. So these, you know, we were just filming what was going on, and it just, and we would ask people, do you support Hamas? And people would dance around the question and not really answer the question. And then it wasn't until really October 7th, 2024 at the art gallery, where all the people that we've been talking to and filming in, at city councils were out there saying, we are Hamas, we are Hezbollah. And we ended up capturing one of the speakers saying, death to Canada, death to the United States, and death to Israel. And that video went viral. And, you know, 8 days later, Samadun was finally declared a terrorist entity, something that Jewish groups had been calling for a very long time. But yeah, New Westminster, I think what we saw there really shocked us. But it wasn't just happening there. There was a template that was very well organized, and they just went everywhere to every city council. So, okay, just pass this resolution. And sadly, councils across BC just, you know, rubber stamped those ceasefire motions without really realizing what they were doing.
And sitting in the mayor's chair, of course, Patrick Johnstone with Community First New Westminster. He's been preoccupied the last couple of years after taking that trip to Dubai to the United Nations Climate Change Conference.
The trip to Dubai was, I think, a debacle on many levels. It wasn't just that he, you know, this kind of more the mechanics of and the very granular rules around what you can accept and what you cannot accept, and what constitutes a conflict of interest or disclosable conflict. And he was found guilty. But I think the larger narrative is that the sponsorship came from this organization called C3 Cities, which is funded by Bloomberg Philanthropies. You know, here we are with this threat of tariffs and the annexation of Canada. And in the name of climate change, Patrick Johnstone is accepting significant amounts of money from an American billionaire. Effectively, that's what's happened here. So there's the question of influence. So these 100 cities around the world are supposedly climate leaders, and the mayors, it's very clever what they do. They target the mayors as if the mayors have any real legislative power. They can't really do anything without the support of the full council. But I think it's a sort of a vanity play where, let's have the mayors get profile as climate change leaders. And there was another thing that flowed out of that, is that the bigger money was that Bloomberg Philanthropies handed John Stone $50,000 to use as kind of a slush fund for what he called youth climate action. So he's doling out this 50 grand to quote unquote youth, you know, high school kids, elementary school kids, for various climate action advocacy. So it's really, I think it is a bit of a travesty. No, number one, that he saw fit to go to Dubai, but he's also accepting what was originally, described as a personal. It's funny the way the Bloomberg philanthropy sort of packaged it. It was for the mayors. So, yeah, he was very happy to take the money, and now is in the process of handing out and doling out this money. And of course, it's always a photo op for him, and it raises his profile. But so you got to wonder, well, who's influencing who, and what is it exactly is the aim of these Bloomberg organization? And and how does it benefit, the average citizen in New Westminster? New Westminster is kind of a small town, but there's no end. I think of it as kind of a microcosm of the larger cities and, the country as a whole, all these things that, flow through. They kind of touch on some of these, bigger regional issues.
What's going on in New Westminster these days is through the New Westminster Times, edited by Dave Brett, who's been our guest on the podcast. And the website is newwesttimes.com. So thanks for joining us on the Breaker.News podcast.
Thanks for having me, Bob. Much appreciated.
Brace yourself for a higher cost of living. March 4th is the EB-NDP government's 2025 budget day in British Columbia. And according to Donald Trump, it will also be Tariff Tuesday. On February 24th, 86 BC lawmakers from across the three parties voted to condemn Trump's plan to slap 25% duties on Canadian goods exported to the United States. Five MLAs, all conservative, voted against Motion 7. Two of those MLAs are guests on this podcast, Brent Chapman of Surrey South and Dallas Brody of Vancouver Quilchina. We'll hear first from Brent Chapman. There were five MLAs, Armstrong, Brody, Keeley, Maz, and you, Brent Chapman, who voted against this motion. So why, with Canadians of all political stripes right now being concerned about the impact to the economy, as well as Trump's rhetoric about Canada being the 51st state or becoming the 51st state, why did you vote this way?
Well, if you read on in the motion, it wasn't as simple as the first line. There's another line that goes with it, or another paragraph that talks about going along with the Team Canada approach of targeting Republican areas in the United States to single them out and punish them harder to try and bring attention to Donald Trump, that there could be drastic effects to those people down there who supported him. Now, I mean, you're now politicizing a fight that doesn't need to be politicized. And if you to do that, are you going to raise the ire of the Trump administration against British Columbia specifically, because we went to make an official declaration that we're going after the people who supported him? So is that really a wise thing to do at this point? Are we in a powerful position that we can withstand extra punitive retaliation from Donald Trump if he decides? I don't know how Mr. Trump thinks. I mean, I don't like any of the rhetoric about being a 51st state or the tariffs that he's brought about. But that being said, why would you walk down that? And if that is your plan, why tip your cards? Hold them to your vest and do what you're going to do. But to start making declarations publicly and officially that's pretty brazen, and I'm not sure we're in a position to play that game with that, you know, with that kind of card player. I think it's a little dangerous.
Now, during the pandemic, when John Horgan was the premier, and when the federal government wasn't doing enough at our airports to stop the spread of COVID-19, John Horgan sent Ravi Kelan to the airport. He hasn't been sent to the border. Now, do you think that the BC government is doing enough to network with the federal authorities whose job it is to secure the border? And should the BC government be doing more at the border?
I think it would be a simple solution to the questions that's asked of us that we at least did that, to find out what's going on at our ports and how that that we're apparently only looking at inspecting 1% of the cargo that's coming through here, and these containers, that we should be doing more, and we should insist the Canadian government do more. So yes, I think it's a good question, and I believe we should be doing more and pushing the federal government to surveil the border tougher on our side, even just for appearance sake. That shows that we're taking these concerns of the American administration seriously. And, you know, there seems to be all kinds of stories, but let's get to the bottom of them and find out what's really going on and what's coming through in these containers, and why, you know, why did we only get, was it 42 pounds of drugs caught at our border going south? That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't show what a great job we're doing. It shows that there's some weaknesses.
Why did you vote this way against Motion 7?
So to my mind, this motion was really an obvious and immature NDP trap. I would have supported it if an amendment had been possible. I don't know if the people have read the motion carefully, but buried within the motion was this vindictive sentence that was included that said British Columbia will single out Republican states in particular for special penalties by our government. Of course, you know, I'm upset that there are going to be tariffs put on Canada. No one wants this. But my view is that we are not going to help ourselves by getting into the proverbial pissing match with Donald Trump. Singling out Republican states, I don't know why we would do that.
Should provincial officers be sent to help with border security like in Ontario? Because that is the message that Donald Trump has given, is that he wants less fentanyl and fewer illegal aliens coming across the U.S. border. And if that's to happen, well, that would also make British Columbia safer.
I couldn't agree more. I think we need to work with the United States on, frankly, the legitimate issues they have raised about our border, our lack of military commitment, are seemingly constantly relying on them for things, and then quite frequently being rude to them and expecting them to just always be a good friend. As a neighbor of theirs, I think we have a duty to pull our weight and be good neighbors. And as to your point about helping ourselves at the same time, I agree with that. Canada benefits if we have a stronger border, that if we have a stronger military that people are proud of. Right now, I've been told that even the military gear that people have is still from the 50s and 60s. If we had to fight for ourselves right now, our soldiers would not be able to fight properly. The message that Trump's been sending is that we need to do our part. And, you know, we need the United States and they need us too, but we don't have enough cards to play in this game this brinkmanship that we're playing with them. I don't think it's wise. We can stand up for Canada without hurling insults at Donald Trump and red states and all of these things.
March 4th is budget day, scheduled budget day here in British Columbia. It's the day that Donald Trump says he will be placing tariffs against Canada. Should the NDP delay the budget day until we know what the big picture will be?
Actually, you sort of caught me off guard there, Bob. I'm not sure what to say to that question. Should we delay? I think that I'll say we probably won't delay, but they had better be very careful in their forecasts, their spending habits, what they're planning, and this rhetoric that we've been hurling is not good. I've been watching how Alberta has been dealing with this whole situation, and I think that their approach of trying to work with the United States on these issues has actually already yielded results for their province. I believe their tariff was reduced down already to 10%, which is lower than what other provinces are going to get. I know people don't, not everybody wants to agree with Donald Trump. I know that, it's obvious. Everybody has different political takes on this. But we will do better by working with the United States than against them. And Donald Trump is the president right now, and we should work hard to, you know, get a better deal for our province with him. In terms of the budget, I don't know how he could delay doing the budget, but you know, I'm pretty new to politics, Bob, and so that's a bigger question than I think I'm able to answer right now.
That was Dallas Brody, and before her, Brent Chapman, both members of the Conservative Party of BC Opposition Caucus. And a postscript. Both of the interviews took place before Donald Trump's shocking and, dare I say, rude, February 28th White House meeting with Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In FocusTaiwan.tw, Russia is the aggressor. Ukrainians in Taiwan tell the world at protest. U.S. President Donald Trump's recent false claim that Ukraine started the war with Russia. Around 100 Ukrainians and supporters protested outside the de facto Russian embassy in Taipei ahead of the third anniversary of the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine. As of February, Taiwan's government has allocated more than $130 million for infrastructure projects in Ukraine, such as bridges, hospitals, churches, and schools, while private donations have exceeded $32 million, according to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. In ABC News Australia, Defense Minister Richard Marles has urged Australia to take a deep breath in response to Chinese warships conducting drills off Australia's east coast, reiterating that they abided by legal principles. His comments came after the coalition accused the government of underplaying the episode, which it said exposed the limits of Australia's China strategy. In Kyoto News, births in Japan in 2024 fall to a record low of 721,000. The figure, down by 5% from the previous year, comes as more people choose to marry later in life and there is increased anxiety over child rearing due to the higher cost of living. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, after Democrat dragged out, GOP town hall reconvenes, draws police and motorcycle patriot group. The Kootenai County Republican Central Committee convened an orderly meeting Tuesday in contrast to a legislative town hall the party hosted over the weekend where private security guards were filmed dragging a woman out of the auditorium at Coeur d'Alene High School. Several members of the motorcycle club Panhandle Patriots attended Tuesday's meeting wearing patched leather jackets. Members are known for their direct involvement in a variety of conservative causes. In the Cascadia Daily News, tensions rise among residents in Washington and BC border cities. Crossings and commerce are down, but declarations of Canadian pride are up in Blaine since President Trump started talking tariffs and annexation. At the Peace Arch City Cafe and Bar, less than a mile from the Canadian border, two servers bustled through the nearly empty restaurant. Business has dropped nearly 30% as tensions between the United States and Canada grow. At a museum gift shop in White Rock, BC, staff were putting out extra Canada Day t-shirts, typically packed away during this time of year, as more and more people purchase items displaying Canadian patriotism. And check out the stories behind the headlines on thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com, such as Inside Metro Vancouver's Communications Spending and Ken Sim's Party Relied on Signal Messaging App, says ex-official. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com.
That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, cause love will conquer.
virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to search and rescue volunteers who serve and sacrifice to rescue people from the wilderness. It is Search and Rescue Memorial Week in BC. Thank you for your service. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to Bob at thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 2nd, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 2nd of March in 1962, Wilt Chamberlain set an NBA record with 100 points? Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas at bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News as news happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week.